This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Cyber attacks occur all the time, and in this digital age, our vulnerability to and the danger of these attacks is becoming clearer all the time. What's considered the largest ransomware attack in history occurred this past weekend in America. To learn about this, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes. If you listening to this are a budding criminal, well, firstly, probably don't break any laws. But secondly, robbing banks is not where it's at anymore. Cybercrime is quickly emerging as the way to get rich. Quick. We've had quite a few big dramatic stories. This one probably lacks the drama of some of the previous ones, the pipeline shut down or the meat packing factories being shut down. Instead, maybe less eye-catching, but much bigger. There's a ransomware attack on kind of a back-end software company. Kaiser VSA is the particular piece of software that has been affected by this ransomware attack. And it's just a fairly piece of mundane software that computer administrators use to keep systems and servers up to date, to make sure that all the software they're running is correctly patched, ironically enough, to make sure there aren't any vulnerabilities, and to kind of keep all their IT systems running. That was hacked by a ransomware group, R-Evil. And they are demanding $70 million to give back control of these different systems. There's potentially 1,500 businesses hit by this ransomware attack that took place over the July 4th weekend. Businesses, I think this is, like I said, rather than, say, one big business that we've all heard of, this is lots of individual smaller businesses that have been hit by this. And I doubt this particular piece of software or the risks thereof was anywhere near the owners of these businesses' radar, but it has now become a major headache for them.
What were some of the effects that different nations experienced because of this attack?
Well, like I said, this is something it's mostly affected smaller businesses. Because it's not like, say, an attack on a meat processing plant or one big critical industry, I don't know if there have been any major national level effects. This is something more that is going to cause a lot of economic damage as it affects lots of different smaller companies.
So these companies that there were so many different companies affected that the people who conducted the attack actually stopped dealing with them individually and trying to seek individual ransoms. They published, basically they said, we'll deal with all of them at once, which indicated that this was a widespread, massive kind of attack. Maybe you can just tell us about the ramifications of just how widespread this was.
Yeah, they're one of the administrators, for example, at Maryland Town, he just said everything shut down. You couldn't open any document. You're completely locked out from all your files. It affected co-op supermarkets in Sweden, where their point of sale systems failed. It's affected a handful of schools in New Zealand. So it's all of these different industries all around the world. And it's like you try to use a computer and you can't. You don't have access to your own files. I think if everybody is doing disaster recovery and backups and things like that the way that they should be doing on paper, it seems like it wouldn't be a major problem. The reality is nobody really does it the way that you should be doing it on paper. And so it causes terrible disruption for all of these different industries.
So this is a subject that we've monitored fairly closely over the years. Our editor-in-chief has drawn attention to some of these attacks even decades ago. Why is it that this is so important to look at from the standpoint of Bible prophecy?
Yeah, we actually had an article on this, or I wrote an article on this in our latest Trumpet print. Cyber attacks expose our fragile world, just as we're seeing how disruptive these can be. I mean, Mr. Gerald Flurry, like you said, all the way back, I think in 1994, he was drawing attention to this, or 1995. There's a very specific prophecy in Ezekiel chapter 7 and verse 14 that warns, they've blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes forth for the battle. You know, there's this situation. Well, Mr. Flurry writes, it seems everybody's expecting our people to go into battle, but the greatest tragedy imaginable occurs. Nobody goes to battle even though the trumpet is blown. Will it be because of a computer terrorist? America is the greatest superpower this world has ever known, he wrote in that article. But we have a very vulnerable point in our military, our own Achilles heel. It's so dangerous, I am amazed it hasn't received more publicity, just because of how much damage you can do through this kind of attack. And I think what we're seeing more and more is it can be so disruptive. You know, there are major prophecies in the Bible about disruptions that occur at, you know, throughout society. You know, the Bible has a lot to say about the curses that are coming upon Britain and America very soon, and then even, you know, widening beyond that. And they talk about food shortages, they talk about societal breakdown. And as you see some of these cyber attacks roll out and shut down entire industries or shut out fuel to entire regions, you can see how cyber attacks could very easily play a role in the fulfillment of these prophecies. So, you know, the Bible has these very clear prophecies that are pretty dire, that have a very sobering picture of life ahead. But at the same time, you know, a lot of these prophecies come from the book of Ezekiel, and it's a book that's also full of hope, that points to a God that corrects and teaches. So, you know, this is all happening according to a very clear and a definite plan with a fantastic ending. But you can get, I think, a small picture of just how sobering the immediate time ahead is at looking at some of these attacks. But I go through more of that in that Trumpet Print article, Cyber Attacks Expose Our Fragile World. And then the most recent version of Mr. Gerald Flurry's article is America's Achilles Heel and Germany, that talks about more about those prophecies as well.
All right. Thank you very much for that. You will link to both of those articles in our show notes for today's program. And also, we have an article up at the website by Josue Michels called "A Cyber Attack Against a U.S. Company Triggers a Chain Reaction." Really, it did affect far beyond America, many countries around the world that were affected by this. But go check those articles out at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Attacks on America's presence in Iraq are increasing. One analyst says Iran has effectively declared war on the U.S. there. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, this analyst is Seth Fransman, that writes for the Jerusalem Post, and he had an article this week which documented a series of attacks that have happened inside Iraq against U.S. forces since July 4th. And the latest one, there actually might be one that's happening right now or just happened recently in Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan, a territory to the north of Baghdad in northern Iraq. But there have been one each day, at least one each day, since July 4th. On Thursday morning, the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad was attacked. There were daily attacks again against in Erbil at the international airport there, where there's an American base that just adjoins that airport. The Al-Assad base in western Iraq has been attacked as well. And also U.S. forces in Syria have been attacked. And each of these attacks are becoming more sophisticated, not just involving these dumb rockets that are fired into the air and hopefully they hit their target, but they're being the Iranian-backed militias are using weaponized drones. And, of course, Iran has been mobilizing a massive drone arsenal and really using copies of U.S. drones that have been downed in Iraq over time to create these drones. And they've been giving them to these militias operating inside Iraq that answer to Iran, and they have increasingly been targeting U.S. forces specifically. And Seth Fransman says this, quote, "This is a concerted and coordinated campaign against the U.S. It's not a simple campaign either. The use of drones in attacks is part of a new strategy." And then it says Iran's use of drones and rockets provided to the militias in Iraq against diplomatic sites and also against the U.S. military is unprecedented. Speaking of what's happened in this past week, again, I wonder how many of our listeners have actually heard about this, especially after the so-called proportional attacks that the Biden administration has made against basically transit points of Iranian assets on the Syria-Iraqi border. There have been two strikes of the Biden administration against targets that aren't really targets. There's face-saving attacks by the retributive attacks by the Biden administration. And that's clearly evident by the fact that Iran is not drawing down at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says this in the end of his article. Well, this is because it's clear that Tehran can dial up the attacks when it wants to. This time, the escalation began on July 4th. It was a message that coincided with the U.S. leaving Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. Iran thinks it can push the U.S. out of Iraq at the same time. And it looks like that's what we're seeing with these increasing attacks.
Well, yeah, you can't look at what's happening here in Iraq without thinking of not only the larger foreign policy that the Biden administration is enacting against Iran, where it just seems to be unwilling to exact any kind of punitive measures against it to speak of. It's really empowering Iran in a lot of ways, but then right against the withdrawal from Afghanistan at the same time. And what consequences would Iran suffer for launching these kinds of attacks against the United States when it's clear the larger policy of America is let's get out of here?
Yeah, and I think that is the big takeaway here. I don't think Iran recognizes that they're stepping up these attacks just as the United States has said that it wants to leave the region, and it's doing so in an amazing way out of Afghanistan. There was a press conference this week with Joe Biden taking questions on the Afghanistan withdrawal. That date now is moved up to August 31st to absolute complete withdrawal of U.S. forces. And it's difficult to see how Afghanistan is going to go forward. Three checkpoints or border crossings have been lost to the Taliban already, to Uzbekistan, Pakistan, and Iran. The Talibanis, they were in Iran this week negotiating with the Iranian government what to do next, what post-U.S. Afghanistan will look like. Michael Rubin had a piece just today entitled Expect Global Bloodletting After Afghan Withdrawal Fiasco. The way the U.S. is leaving is showing those terrorists across the Middle East that you can hit the United States without expecting a strong deterring response from the United States going forward. This is him, Michael Rubin, again today in the Washington Examiner. He writes, for Washington, the long-term impact of the Afghan withdrawal will be evident not only in Afghanistan, where the Taliban may soon rampage over a more cosmopolitan, tolerant generation. Rather, the U.S. will pay the price in the Horn of Africa, in Iraq, in Libya, and areas of the Middle East that now seem placid and calm. And so all of the United States' enemies are watching the U.S. leave Afghanistan with its tail between its legs, and they're saying, huh, we have a free pass to step up our attacks because we no longer fear the United States. And it's interesting, what areas did Michael Rubin talk about? He talked about these areas that the Bible says that Iranian-backed terrorists or Iranian-backed Islamists directed by Iran are going to take over. Watch out in the Horn of Africa. Al-Shabaab operating out of Somalia right now. The United States is already withdrawn from there. Are they going to be fearful of the United States' retribution if they step up their attacks? Libya also. These are regions we know that Iran is going to take over. And so here we see somewhat calm in these areas. But what are the lessons they're going to learn from the Afghani withdrawal? We're already seeing that take place in Iraq right now with these increased attacks against U.S. forces.
Yeah, it's an extremely dangerous message that the Biden administration is sending really to dangerous groups and nations around the world. Thank you very much for that, Brent. You can read about this more from our article, which we'll link to in the show notes for today's program, America's Greatest Defeat, Iran's Victory. Really important prophetic trend that's taking place there in the Middle East. China is undertaking a project that significantly boosts its threat as a nuclear power. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, new satellite imagery shows that China is currently constructing 119 new silos for intercontinental ballistic missiles in the northwest part of the country, and then about 25 more are being built in other parts of the nation. So these images were published by the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies, and the new silos are believed to be for China's DF-41 ICBMs. So the DF-41, that's one that we've discussed a few different times on Trumpet Hour, because it is just a truly impressive missile. These have a range of 9,300 miles, and they're able to carry a very substantial nuclear payload. So with that range, that means they could send Chinese nuclear weapons across the Pacific and deliver them to the U.S. mainland. And for China to have 145 new silos going up for these nuclear-capable missiles, it really just shows that, as you said there, the nuclear threat posed by China is increasing. China's arsenal is still quite a lot smaller than those of the U.S. or Russia. They're believed to only have about 300 nuclear weapons presently, but they seem to be planning to deploy more of them. And then we spoke on the show just a few weeks back about China also building a lot of new fast-breed reactors, which could mean quite a lot more, just a larger number of weapons very soon. So this is just the latest development showing that the nuclear threat that mankind faces is far from over, and in fact, it is growing more menacing in some nations.
Now, China is a nuclear power. It's been a nuclear power for quite some time, but significantly less, fewer weapons than, say, the United States or Russia. If those who would look at that and say, well, it really doesn't pose much of a threat, how would you answer that?
Well, really, with nuclear weapons, it only takes one.
Right.
You know, these are just unfathomably destructive weapons. We've seen what the far smaller, kind of the precursor, the atomic bomb, was able to do in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And really, the atomic bomb is only basically a fuse for current nuclear weapons. So if China only has 300 of them, that's still enough to wreak unimaginable devastation if they chose to push the button.
Now, this is happening at the same time that Russia is also making a major show of nuclear strength.
Yes, it was on Monday that Russia sent three of its Oscar II-class nuclear-powered cruise missile submarines, as well as two other nuclear submarines, into the Baltic Sea. So these vessels are believed to be on their way to take part in a naval parade that'll be held off the coast of St. Petersburg a little later this month. And if that's the case, it will mark the first time that Russia has included so many nuclear submarines in this naval parade. In the past, from what I can tell, the most that have taken part was two. But now it looks like they'll have at least three and maybe up to five. And so Kremlinologists are viewing this as just a major show of strength for Russia. They also believe that it is largely in response to the incident in the Black Sea just 2 weeks ago when Britain's HMS Defender transited those waters that were claimed by Russia. But, you know, in either case, this is just a stunning amount of firepower that'll be on display here, and it demonstrates Russia's rising power in a dramatic way.
Nuclear warfare is something that just doesn't hit people's radar all that much. It's been a threat for really decades now, but Bible prophecy tells us we really do need to be concerned about this.
It does, yes, and really, it's not just Russia and China. You know, in recent months, Iran has advanced its nuclear weapons program. That regime could be just months away from producing its first bomb. There's also North Korea, another very fanatical and probably even less stable regime than Iran that has recently made big improvements in the delivery systems for its nuclear weapons. Then in Germany, military personnel have been receiving more and more training about how to drop the nuclear bombs that America has stocked in Germany. There's also Pakistan, where more concerns are coming up over just how vulnerable its nuclear weapons are to terrorist hijacking, especially since America is now pulling out of neighboring Afghanistan, which we just heard Brent discuss. You know, that's leading to, you know, terrorists just taking over great swaths of the region there. So in so many nations, nuclear developments are underway that expose just how fragile the global peace is. And as you said, if you look at Bible prophecy, there are many passages that talk about a war that will soon break out. Matthew 24 tells us it'll be so devastating, it will have the potential to erase all human life from the planet. So, you know, from that detail, we can tell that that is talking about nuclear war. So when we see China building more nuclear silos, when we see Russia reminding the world that it has this unfathomable nuclear power hiding beneath the waves in its submarines, all of that shows us that this war is approaching. And that's an alarming reality. It's as alarming as anything we could contemplate. But those same prophecies that talk about this nuclear war also show that the world will not end in nuclear winter. The war will be interrupted by the most exciting and just, you know, history-altering event that the world has ever experienced. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has written an entire booklet on this subject. It's called Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. He goes through the details of the prophecies about that devastating war, but he also allots quite a lot of space to the good news, to that interruption and everything that follows it. So I hope that listeners will visit thetrumpet.com to order their free copy of Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door.
All right, outstanding. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Some fireworks this past week between America's NSA and Fox News host Tucker Carlson. To get to the bottom of this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, NSA spying's been a scandal that many people have been concerned about for years, but I think it really hit a new high watermark over the last 2 weeks. It was actually last week that the Fox News host Tucker Carlson came out and told his viewers that the NSA actually had been reading his emails in an attempt to cancel his show. And a lot of people were skeptical or even mocked that claim when he made it last week. But then there's been two new big developments this week. One, it's come out that Tucker Carlson, he was hoping to get an interview with a Russian president, Vladimir Putin, in corresponding back and forth with the Russian government there, but keeping it kind of quiet because he didn't want to rattle the political scene in Russia and make it less likely for Putin to say yes. But the NSA found out about that in these emails and actually leaked the information about these emails to a journalist in Washington, D.C. So that is kind of confirmation that the NSA was was reading the emails, because like, well, how did this journalist get this information? Mm-hmm. And the other big thing that came out is the NSA issued a denial of the claims Tucker Carlson was making, which and actually, if you look at the denial, it's kind of humorous. I've got an article here from actually a former CIA analyst who said that he literally laughed out loud when Tucker Carlson said he was being spied on by the NSA. He thought it was so ridiculous until he read the denial, and that's what convinced him that this was really happening, because it was definitely a politician's denial, where they said that, like, Tucker Carlson has never been a target of the NSA, and we're not trying to cancel his show. But he's like, okay, but what about the
specific
spying on the email? They're like, okay, you've denied the motive that you weren't doing it to cancel the show, and you've said he's not a target, which is a very vague term. It's like, maybe you were spying at someone else on Fox News, hoovered up his emails inadvertently, and then leaked it to the journalist. But so there's many ways that the NSA could have been spying on Tucker Carlson without him fulfilling the Webster's definition of target.
Yeah.
And so it was really interesting, actually, this article from this CIA analyst, Fred Flates. It's posted at the Federalist, and he even talks about some of the reasons that he originally didn't believe it, just because of how big a scandal this is, where he was saying that, like, well, he's like, for this to happen, because he was in the CIA, he knows a little bit about the inner workings of the intelligence community, he said that would have had to have been approved, like, pretty much all the way at the top by, like, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. This isn't just something like an intern could do. And well, now that this denial's convinced him that the spying likely happened, you have to step back and think, it's like, okay, yeah, he's right. This is something that likely goes all the way to the top of the NSA, and possibly even beyond that to Joe Biden himself, spying on this this conservative journalist and really trying to do the same thing to him that the Obama administration did to Mike Flynn.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember, we actually, that's the article we can put in the show notes, is the Barack Obama mystery, where our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, goes through the details of the Mike Flynn case, where Barack Obama was using the NSA to illegally spy on Mike Flynn's phone calls, found out about some innocent conversations he was having with the Russian ambassador, and leaked that to the media early to make it look like he was engaged in this suspicious activity. Tucker Carlson said the same thing. He said they're spying on my emails, found out these this correspondence I had with the Russian government trying to get an interview with Vladimir Putin. I hadn't made that correspondence public because I didn't want to make it less likely for Putin to accept the interview. But then when the NSA spied about it, didn't tell me about it, leaked it to a journalist, and then told everyone else before I had a chance to explain myself, now it looks like, what's he trying to hide? Mm. It's a patsy setup that, I mean, I don't think they'd have anything legal they could do against Tucker Carlson, but it definitely try to make him look like he was involved in suspicious activity that he wasn't telling anyone about.
Yeah. Yeah, it just underscores so many of the strands of story that we've been following for quite some time with respect to the Obama administration, the willingness of the left to do whatever is required to target their political enemies. Tucker Carlson obviously has a target on his back for a lot of the things that he's been saying over the last several years. And their willingness to spy on people is a tremendous amount of power that these agencies have to be able to do this. And if they're not restrained by a respect for the law, there's nothing really to restrain them. And then underscoring all of that, too, is the media's complicity in all of this, that just really mocking Tucker Carlson for making patently true statements.
Right. Yeah. That's a big thing where just a little bit of common sense. You're kind of like, okay, well, on the one hand, you're mocking him for saying the NSA is spying on you. And then on the other hand, you're accusing him of being a Russian stooge for trying to get an interview with Vladimir Putin. And then you're thinking, like, well, how do you know that he was trying to get an interview with Vladimir Putin? Like, so his emails were leaked to a journalist. Someone did it.
Mm-hmm.
And the NSA is not denying it. They're, like I said, if they were legally confident that they could just come out and say, we didn't read Tucker Carlson's emails, they would have come out and said, we didn't read Tucker Carlson's emails. Instead, they had wrote up an entire letter trying to deny allegations and just tiptoeing around the elephant in the room,
mm-hmm.
saying that he's not a target, we're not trying to cancel his show. But it's like I said, but did you read his emails, yes or no?
Right. Yeah. Well, Mr. Gerald Flory, our editor-in-chief, is working on a new booklet right now about this very thing, about just the dangers posed by the radical left, and particularly Barack Obama and those who have worked for him. He's going to be finishing that hopefully within the next few weeks, and it'll be available this fall. In the meantime, read that article, The Barack Obama Mystery. We'll link to that in the show notes for today's program. We appreciate that. Andrew, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, a very revealing judgment by the European Union against German car makers, more pressure by the Biden administration against Israel in its dealings with the Palestinians, and the progress China is making in its space program, and more. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The European Union likes to present itself as a rules-based organization protecting consumers from corporate greed and defending competitive markets. But in a ruling this week, this facade was exposed. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is the same European Union that makes American tech giants quail, that has put around 15 billion euro fine on Apple, that Apple later appealed and won for doing something that was perfectly legal in Ireland. It's fined Google around 10 billion euros in several different actions. Here it was confronted with a situation where Volkswagen, BMW, Mercedes, several of these big German car manufacturers all work together to make their cars less environmentally friendly than they could have been otherwise. They agreed that they would not compete with each other on making their diesel cars more environmentally friendly, that they would just kind of stick to the minimum required by law and not compete any further. So, you know, cheating in competition, cartels, the environment, this is everything that the European Union kind of talks against. The result, though, was a slap on the wrist. The Volkswagen, about $1 billion fine, 875 million euros. And that was for Volkswagen, BMW, Daimler that owns Mercedes. They were let off because they blew the whistle on this thing. So something that really is just loose change for such a huge company. Their share price barely even moved once the fine was announced, just because it's not really going to make much of a difference to them. So it is, like you said, it's a revealing incident that shows the EU is not so much about rules-based international order or rule of law or anything like that. And a lot of their consumer action is about punishing America and protecting and awarding German companies as much as it is about helping consumers.
How significant is it that it's German companies that the European Commission was so favorable toward?
Yeah, it's evidence, yet more evidence, that Germany is the one that calls the shots really in Europe. And I've written recently in Trumpet Briefs how there's a bit of pushback from Brussels on this, but it just confirms at the end of the day, Germany is the one in charge. And all the way back in September 2011, Trumpet editor-in-chief has a kind of a landmark article, World's Greatest Danger, Germany Domineers Over Europe Again. And what he does in this article is show how this situation with Germany ruling over Europe was prophesied in the Bible. This is exactly what the Bible forecast thousands certainly thousands of years ago, and that this is dangerous. And he goes through even history and Bible prophecy showing the repercussions of Germany ruling over Europe. So that's what this story demonstrates, and you can read more about how dangerous that is in that article, World's Greatest Danger, Germany Domineers Over Europe Again.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. The relationship between America and Israel is in tough shape these days, with yet another anti-Israel policy coming out of the Biden administration. To learn about this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this past week, Israel demolished a house of a terrorist. This is a lawful act that the state of Israel believes defers future terrorist attacks, whereby if there is terrorist attack that kills an Israeli citizen, that as promptly as possible, the Israeli military will raise that house to the ground. And so this happened as per Israel's policy for a number of years, except this time you had the Biden administration release several statements, both from the embassy here in Jerusalem and also from the State Department in Washington, D.C., that the United States does not believe this is a good act. This is a good thing to do. This is what Ned Price said. He's a spokesperson at the State Department. We attach a good deal of priority to this, knowing that the home of an entire family shouldn't be demolished for the action of one individual. So that's the United States position. And it looks like the United States is really pushing hard on this. There was an appeal to the High Court in Israel directly before this demolition. And who was sitting there in the High Court but representatives of the United States Embassy in Jerusalem to hear the case? A really bizarre intrusion into Israeli internal policy here, especially in regard to what it sees as an effective policy to deter future terrorist attacks. This is what Carolyn Glick wrote about this. She said, as a practical matter, there is no rational reason for the administration to be throwing a hissy fit over Israel's destruction of a terrorist murderer's home. It is legal and an effective counterterrorist move. And then she writes, the terrorist in question was a naturalized U.S. citizen. He was radicalized by an American imam in Florida and relocated back to his opulent village with the goal of killing Israelis. And if you saw footage of this, this is a beautiful two-story home. This isn't somebody that was drawn into desperate times based on a lack of income or sorrow over no Palestinian state. This was a very wealthy man with numerous homes in the U.S. and in the West Bank, whose house was demolished. So his reason was he wanted to kill Israelis, and he did kill an Israeli a couple of months ago and injured two others. And then Carolyn Glick continues. Moreover, thanks to the administration's decision to reinstate its funding of the Palestinian Authority, the terrorist is guaranteed a lifelong income of excess of $50,000 a year for his family, more than the average per capita income in Israel. Then this is how she concludes her comments. Why is the U.S. condemning Israel for acting effectively against a terrorist? The most obvious reason is that the administration doesn't want Israel to defeat or deter Palestinian terrorists. If that is true, then the Biden administration cannot be credibly viewed as an ally. And so we're seeing again the Biden administration intruding where it has never done so before. And in this case, really getting to the heart of one of Israel's measures to deter future terrorist attacks against its citizens.
So as I mentioned, this is really the latest in a series of moves that the Biden administration has been making that really shows what a stark turnaround there's been between this administration and the Trump administration in its dealings with Israel. Maybe you could just give us the overview of what's happening here.
Yeah, this really does go back to what we've discussed previously about how there's a changing position by the United States in favor of the Palestinians and the control that they have over the West Bank in particular. And obviously this was a house that was razed inside the West Bank to the ground. And there were other actions that the Biden administration has taken. We've talked about how they've got numerous properties that belong to Israeli organizations that are currently lived in by squatters in East Jerusalem, and that the Israeli law says that they should be vacated from these properties since they haven't paid rent in 30 years. And the United States has intruded into that as well, putting out statements, talking to the Israeli authorities, saying you cannot remove these people because they're in East Jerusalem. And the statement that really kicked this off was on May 7th, and this was 3 days before that mini war between Israel and Hamas from the United States. And the statement said this, and I think it's interesting because it mentions home demolitions. Price, again, from the State Department said, as we have consistently said, it's critical to avoid steps that exacerbate tensions or take us further away from peace. This includes evictions in East Jerusalem, settlement activity, home demolitions, and acts of terrorism. And so here we see them being true to their word. The United States is now going to fight Israel's legal action against terrorists that do commit major terrorist attacks with Israeli civilians being killed. It's basically saying to Israel, you're not free to act in a way that you see would deter future terrorist actions. And so as we wrote in our article back in the latest, well, the previous Trumpet, well, the latest Trumpet edition, is the fall of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, imminent? We really did look at this changing position of the Biden administration in support of the Palestinians as a way of really limiting and curtailing Israel's sovereignty to act independently of the United States in East Jerusalem, to act independently to act in its own self-interest inside East Jerusalem. And the Biden administration is laying down its policy that it does favor Palestinians living in East Jerusalem, Israelis not having jurisdiction to enforce its laws in East Jerusalem. And now it's saying to Israel that you can't even demolish a terrorist house. And this is a major change from the Trump administration, who really did recognize in many ways the way the Middle East works. Yes, should a whole family of a terrorist suffer because one man committed the act? Maybe not. But is it an effective deterring policy against future terrorist attacks? Yes, it is. And so that is the policy Israel has chosen. And the Trump administration was fully on board with Israel's right to self-defense and Israel's right to act in this way.
Yeah, that article that you mentioned, Is the Fall of East Jerusalem Imminent, a really important article to read because it puts everything that has been happening here with the Biden administration regarding Israel in its context, points back to the record that the Obama administration established, and it points to just the dangers associated with this split between the United States and Israel and where this is leading to violence increasing in Jerusalem in direct fulfillment of biblical prophecy. And as you see these events unfold, you definitely do. It brings those prophecies to mind in a really dramatic way. So I do encourage you to read that article, Is the Fall of East Jerusalem Imminent, from our August 2021 Trumpet edition. Thank you very much for that, Brent. The progress that China is making in several space-related programs is becoming a growing concern for other nations. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, a very concerning report was just published in National Defense Magazine about China's various space programs. And one of the main conclusions of this report is that China has designated space as a military domain, and it is determined to, quote, achieve superiority in this domain by using offensive and defensive means. So, you know, in some ways, this is not all that revolutionary. We've long understood that China's bent on domination, and it's logical that its determination to dominate would extend into low Earth orbit and beyond. But what is interesting about this report is the detail that it provides about just how vulnerable some of America's space-based assets are to China. So it talks about some of the specific satellites that China has been launching and the ability that they have to incapacitate other satellites in orbit. That's the situation with China's SJ-17 satellite. That one was recently launched, and it made a series of orbital maneuvers and rendezvous proximity operations in the geostationary belt there. So that's very alarming to know that this Chinese satellite is up there and could, you know, potentially at any time strike some of the U.S.'s satellites that we rely on so heavily. And then this report also notes some of the nefarious potential of China's new space station in orbit. The first module of that space station was launched in May, and the whole thing could be operational as early as next year. We don't know very much about it yet, but it's coming online very soon. And then it also talks about China's plans for a lunar base. And then I think one of the most concerning topics that this report address is the progress that China's been making with ground-based directed energy weapons that could take down other countries' satellites. There are at least four locations in China that are confirmed to have these weapons in development right now. So, you know, China's space program, like so much of what the nation does, is about destruction and conquest, and it is growing more powerful.
We were talking at the beginning of the program about this ransomware attack, these cyber attacks that target the United States and many other countries as well. This is really very closely related to that. I think it's easy for us to forget just how dependent upon satellites in particular. We were mentioning just how these programs could target satellites. This is almost something that we just don't even want to think about, just what the ramifications of something like this would be if they were to specifically go after those satellites.
Yes, that's a great point, because America has hundreds of satellites in orbit that we, you know, we depend on them for everything from weather monitoring and television broadcasting to all kinds of internet technologies. Of course, we have our GPS system that provides anyone who wants to use it with positioning, navigation, and timing services. And then, of course, most importantly, is that the U.S. military relies on satellites for all kinds of reconnaissance, navigation, communication, and targeting systems. And, you know, listeners might think, well, doesn't most every country have satellites in orbit, and aren't we all equally vulnerable? But America has far more satellites than any other nation, and we depend on them quite a bit more. So America is more vulnerable in this way than any other nation. Frank Rose of the Brookings Institution was quoted in this new report talking about America's vulnerability, and he said, quote, "Adversarial nations, such as China and Russia, are developing anti-satellite weapons because they believe space represents an asymmetric vulnerability of the United States," end quote. And then Steve Lambakis, an international affairs analyst, he's also recently addressed this. He especially emphasized the U.S. military's vulnerability. Just a short quote from him. He said, "U.S. space systems are among the most fragile and vulnerable assets operated by the U.S. military. This infrastructure is worth billions and is vital to nearly every activity of the U.S. and increasingly the armed forces of U.S. allies." So I just think it's amazing that these analysts can see it. The Chinese and the Russians can see it. People understand that this is an extreme vulnerability for America. And if the right satellites were taken out, it could be truly catastrophic for the country.
Richard was talking to us in the first half about just the prophecies that specifically suggest cyber attacks and the loss or the exploitation of these vulnerabilities that you're talking about. What other prophecies do you look at and see as potentially being fulfilled by this kind of capability being developed by the Chinese?
Yeah, well, I think the ones that he was mentioning there definitely relate to this. And then Bible prophecy also discusses a time in the near future when America and some of its current allies will be besieged by China, Russia, and their allies. Isaiah chapter 23 provides a lot of details about that. And then Isaiah 59 discusses more about this future time of calamity for the U.S. Verses 9 and 10 show that the people of America are stripped of vision. So it says, quote, "We wait for light, but behold obscurity. We wait for brightness, but we walk in darkness. We grope as if we had no eyes." So, you know, I think this is already happening in a spiritual sense in America today. It's clear that so many people are groping around in spiritual blindness. But the vision that is absent in this prophecy could also include physical types of seeing, including what Americans currently are able to see with satellite technology. So I think when you put all those scriptures together, it helps us see how the U.S. could be besieged, especially if its satellites are taken out early in that process by China or another nation. So I just think that in light of all those prophecies, we need to keep on closely watching China's space programs as they become more and more militarily capable.
Where would you send people for more information, Jeremiah?
There is an article by our own Richard Palmer. This was in the February 2016 issue of The Trumpet, and it's called Space, the Final Military Frontier. And that one really puts a lot of these prophecies in context and just brings them to life.
All right, thank you very much. One final story on today's program from America, where socialism is growing in popularity. Well, some of the most radical socialists in the nation believe we need to join forces with foreign socialists to succeed in refashioning this country. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, over the Independence Day weekend, while most other Americans were preparing for fireworks shows and barbecues and other ways to celebrate our independence from Britain, the largest overtly socialist political organization in the United States, the Democratic Socialist of America, celebrated in a very different way. They actually left the country, or a delegation of its high leaders, left the country for Venezuela to meet with Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro. And there hasn't been a ton of information come out of that meeting yet. But they know that they did talk mainly about the embargo that America currently has Venezuela under, and most likely ways to like lift or circumvent that embargo. That's been a longstanding policy of the Democratic Socialists of America. Even back in 2016, they were petitioning then President Barack Obama to lift the sanctions on Venezuela. But I think one of the most shocking things of this story isn't necessarily that the Democratic Socialists of America did this, because like I said, they've done it before, but it's just how much more influential this organization is than it was even 5 years ago. 5 years ago, the Democratic Socialists of America had about 6,000 due-paying members and one representative in Congress, a man who's actually no longer in now. And now, in just the 5 years, its membership has really exploded from 6,000 members to 92,000 members. And it has four representatives in Congress: Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Cori Bush, and Jamal Bowman. And so that's quite a bit of congressional representation for a group its size. That's about 1% of Congress. Mm. And then these are just the ones that are like overtly paying dues to an organization that's openly advocating for Venezuelan style socialism in America.
Right. There's a whole lot more Democrats that are certainly sympathetic.
Right. The entire, actually, it was about 2017, I think it was, there was a meeting between the Democratic Socialists of America and the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which was founded by Bernie Sanders, who's a self-described Democratic Socialist, even though he doesn't pay dues to the other organization. Mm-hmm. But during that meeting, they were really like powwowing for ways to work together and push a shared agenda. And the Congressional Progressive Caucus has 90 members in Congress. And so really, you could say that 20% of the House of Representatives and 40% of the entire Democratic Party are Democratic Socialist, to the point where they wouldn't even be offended by the term. And then you still have a few Democrats who are offended by the term, and then like those who, like Elizabeth Warren, who proudly proclaims to be a capitalist, but is probably more radical than even Bernie Sanders when you get down to the nuts and bolts of some of her policy recommendations.
So they visited Venezuela. They're certainly very interested in Venezuela. What lessons can we learn from Venezuela's dalliance with socialism?
Right. Well, that's the article we can have in the show notes, is what the world can learn from Venezuela, or what the world needs to learn from Venezuela. But that really, it is amazing the parallels. I saw a YouTube video once. It was like an on-the-street reporter in Venezuela in 2000, just interviewing just people buying mangoes and stuff on the street and asking them about socialism. And they really sounded like a lot of the Bernie Sanders supporters today, where they're like, yeah, there's this new politician, Hugo Chavez, advocating socialism. It's supposed to eradicate poverty. They're like, I don't know a lot about it, but it's like, let's give it a shot. And now, I mean, you've got like, it takes $1 million to buy a cup of coffee. And I mean, the murder rate's one of the highest in the world, as this socialism's just crunched this country into oblivion. But it really just shows that it's not like what a lot of people imagine the Russian Revolution to be, where like a group of military officers hijacks the country in a violent coup. It was just really, I mean, just average, everyday Venezuelans in a more or less capitalist country who are trying to alleviate poverty. They voted in this demagogue democratically. And then over his time in office, he's like, well, he ran on a socialist platform. He needed to start redistributing wealth. And so he kept taking more and more power to take wealth from those who didn't want to give it up, until he ended up with the control of all branches of government and the military. And then people were, I guess, shocked that he started going into vote rigging. They're like, it's like, oh, we gave you like complete control over our government democratically so you could redistribute wealth. And like, now that you have complete control over our government, you're just not going to get it back. You're going to rig elections in perpetuity and just run this country as a dictatorship, which has happened every single time mm-hmm. someone's tried to establish a socialist state, whether some socialist states are forged in civil wars or coups or military juntas. But there's several in both Cuba and Venezuela. I mean, they came in democratically, but then once they had the power, you just keep that and then and just totally destroy the economy. And it really is a really stark warning to America today. Yeah, there's just so many prophecies about civil war, and like Isaiah 1 and verse 7, Ezekiel 5 and verse 12, about a civil war, even a civil war so devastating that 100 million people will die in America. And it opens the door for you to wonder, is like, well, how are you going to get a civil war that devastating here? And it looks like all the evidence is pointing to something very similar, is like has happened in Venezuela or Soviet Russia, where you're getting society balkanized into two teams, those who are at least nominally trying to hold to a constitutional Republican form of government, and those who are wanting something more like Venezuelan-style socialism. And if it keeps on that path, then you're going to get the same result as you've gotten in some of these countries that have had devastating civil wars over their form of government.
Yes, if only we would heed those warnings, not only of history, but what has happened in very recent years. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Andrew. Do read that. We have an article up by Andrew on thetrumpet.com right now, Democratic Socialists of America Embrace Nicolas Maduro's Socialist Dictatorship. And that will also link to the What the World Needs to Learn from Venezuela that he referenced. And we'll put a link to both of those in the show notes, as well as everything that we've discussed on the program today. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of William James. Our greatest weapon against stress is our ability to choose one thought over another. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.